This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. It is 877-217-5757. InksterShow@WRKF.org. Our guest is Scott Eyman. He's authored 13 books, including two with veteran actor Robert Wagner, both bestsellers, You Must Remember This and Pieces of My Heart. And Scott has received more attention for his latest target than perhaps all his books put together, John Wayne, The Life and Legend. John Wayne, who's been gone almost 35 years, was perhaps the most popular film actor of the 20th century. Between 1926 and 1976, he appeared in more than 170 films, including some of the best-known westerns ever. Wayne portrayed lonely, flawed men of dignity and strength, searching for justice, but over the course of a five-decade career, he became something much greater than a movie star. He became a symbol of America itself. And Scott Eyman gets to the heart of the man who was Marion Morrison and became John Wayne. Good morning, Scott Eyman.
Morning, Jim.
Well, the big screen will always remember John Wayne. People will be watching his movies long after you and I are gone. But you have tackled the man behind the myth as best as anybody could. What did you find?
Well, thanks for the compliment first. I had met Wayne. I spent 90 minutes with him in an interview when I was a kid, 21 years old. It was very few credentials, actually almost none. In retrospect, I don't know what he was doing talking to me outside of sympathy. And the guy that I spent those 90 minutes with was not the guy in the books at all. And he wasn't actually the guy on the screen either. I mean, there was a similarity to the guy on the screen, the size, physical and psychological and emotional and charisma, certainly. But he was a lot more thoughtful than he was on screen. He was more contemplative than he was on screen. He was a gentler person than he was on screen. And I couldn't find evidence of that guy anywhere in the books that have been published about him in the 35 years since he died. So I thought, well, there's of course a possibility that I might have gotten him on a good day. But I decided to start talking to people and family and friends and anybody I could find that had known him to ascertain what he was like as a producer, what he was like as a father, as a husband, and what he was like as an actor as well.
Well, he was a great actor. I don't think there's any doubt about that, although some would say he played the same character over and over, if that was the case, and it probably wasn't. He did that pretty well, didn't he?
He was a very good actor, and I don't think he played the same character over and over. In his later years, I think it could be said that he settled into a groove. But there's certainly no similarity between Nathan Brittles in She Wore Yellow Ribbon and Tom Dunson in Red River, and those films are a year apart. She Wore Yellow Ribbon, he's a very gentle, sad, resigned, grandfatherly figure. In Red River, he's a ferocious, Old Testament, innately angry guy. There's really no similarity between those two people. He could basically play almost any color you wanted him to play. It was a question of what he wanted to play, left to his own devices. If John Ford or Howard Hawks said, do this, he would do it. Left to his own devices with a weaker director, he had a groove that he was comfortable in, that he didn't particularly want to get out of. But he could do he could produce any number of dramatic colors for all you had to do was ask.
And he was such a captivating figure on the screen and represented more than what met the eye. He truly did become a symbol of American supremacy, rightly or wrongly.
Ultimately, yeah. He was very much, he became an exemplar of what Henry Luce called the American century. And in part, it was intentional. He always put his money where his mouth is. He wasn't hesitant about espousing his conservative political beliefs. It cost him a great deal of money. As a matter of fact, over the years, the Alamo kind of wiped him out personally. I mean, being John Wayne, he could go back to work quickly and make some money back, but it did affect his net worth to a great extent. Not because the film was a abject financial failure, but because he was so desperate to make the film that he made a series of very bad financial deals where everybody got their money out of the picture before John Wayne did. And by the time John Wayne was in position to get some money out of the picture was through playing, and there was no money to be had.
Well, he was 4 years older than Ronald Reagan, and Reagan entered the political realm as a candidate for governor in California when he was 55 in 1966 as a conservative. And, of course, Reagan had been a liberal stalwart in the 40s and 50s. But John Wayne, imagine if he had run for governor of California in 1966. Would Reagan have had a shot?
The point is moot because he never would have run for office. He was not... He didn't have the temperament. Reagan had the temperament. Reagan had more of a temperament for politics than he did for show business, actually. Wayne lacked patience. He had a short fuse as a person. He would blow up without a lot of warning. That was over quickly, and he would always apologize. I mean, he didn't hold grudges at all, but he really didn't have patience. And in politics, you have to make deals. You have to compromise. You have to nudge things along slowly. You have to be patient. All the great politicians have that quality, whether it's FDR or Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton or whoever you want to choose. They all have a kind of amiable facade behind which they're scheming and to get their way. But Wayne had great clarity of character, and he didn't really have a temperament for politics. Had he had a slightly different temperament, yes, he would have been an extremely effective politician.
297-5633, your number, outside the area, 877-217-5757 for Scott Iman, his book, John Wayne, The Life and Legend. And it is a book that has been reviewed by just about every major reviewer in the country, and it has invariably received plaudits for unearthing nuggets about the life of John Wayne that have not been unearthed before, despite many, many books and profiles of the Duke. He married three times, and I think it's fair to say, Scott, that he had a certain type of woman he was attracted to.
Very much, yeah. He liked Latin women. All of his wives were Latinas, and all of his marriages were failures. Because essentially he was a workaholic. He was a poor kid. He was a blue-collar kid. He was a jock. And he had a depression mentality before the depression, really, because there was no money in the family except his father was a poor provider. Nice guy, poor provider. And Duke was a much more effective a man in the marketplace than his father ever was. And he was a compulsive. His making movies was not his job. It was his hobby. It was his profession. It was what he loved to do. I didn't understand at the time I talked to him what he was. He was a journeyman movie man. Most people like the movies because of the money or because of the publicity and the renown, and you can get good tables at restaurants and things like that. He liked the process. Very few people like the process because it's not a lot of fun. You act for 30 seconds, and then you wait for a half an hour. You act for a minute, and you wait for 2 hours while they reset the camera and the lights. It's very hard to maintain an edge to not get bored. He loved the process. He loved joshing with the stuntmen. He loved playing chess between setups. He liked being the first guy on the set at 7 in the morning and being the last guy to leave at 6:30 or 7. And that meant he didn't have a lot of time for family. When he was between pictures and he was home, he'd be fine for a couple of weeks, and then he'd start to get restless. And he wanted to be working, and he wanted to get out, and he wanted to be with his extended family as much as with his actual family. So he was as I say in the book, he was a very good father and a very good family man who couldn't sustain a marriage.
Well, he was a, quote, man's man, but I'm sure women were attracted to him, and you note that he had a long affair with none other than Marlena Dietrich.
They made three pictures together, and it was generally thought that they had a brief fling on the first picture. Actually, I found out to be quite the case otherwise. When after he died, his son, Michael, who produced a number of his pictures through the Bat Jack organization, which was Wayne's production company, I think Michael was going to do a biography of some sort, and he sent somebody around to do interviews with people that had known his dad that weren't the obvious suspects, people that an outsider wouldn't even know to talk to. And I had access to those interviews, and they were made clear that the relationship with Dietrich was far more intense and far more extensive than anybody had known previously. She would follow him around on locations because he was working all the time, and she didn't work that much. She wasn't that interested in working. She'd only work when she needed the money. And he worked consistently because, as I said, he really wanted not to be poor. So she would follow him around on locations, you know, so that they could have meetings late at night. And there were occasional meetings even later on in their lives into the 50s.
297-5633, and we have a listener, Hal, who asks about some of Wayne's films. He traveled the world making these films and even did one here in Baton Rouge, The Undefeated, in 1969.
Mm-hmm. The Horse Soldiers, I think, was shot in Louisiana.
It was indeed. You're right. He got to know the country almost as well as the country got to know him.
That's true, and he loved that aspect of it. And he picked up, he got his love of Japanese art when he went to Japan to shoot The Barbarian and the Geisha in 1956, I believe it was. And he brought back some beautiful Japanese screens that decorated his house in Newport Beach for the rest of his life. He had a great, it was a learning experience. Traveling the world and making movies was kind of his higher education, because he had 2 years of college at USC, but had to drop out when he lost his football scholarship, because there was no money in the family, as I said. The only way he could have gotten into USC was with an athletic scholarship. And when he lost his football scholarship, he had to drop out. So making movies was more than just his profession. It was his higher education. It was his finishing school, his college.
Another listener asks about Wayne and the Red Scare in Hollywood. Was the Duke involved in this?
He was initially a member of the Motion Picture Alliance, which was the leading conservative spearhead against what they regarded as the communist insurgency. He later became the president of the Motion Picture Alliance in 1950, I believe. And as I said, he put his money where his mouth is. In 1952, he made a movie called Big Jim McLean, which was a kind of a tribute to the House Un-American Activities Committee. He played an investigator for HUAC, investigating communist insurgency in American industries. It was kind of a marker he laid down in terms of the Cold War as to his conservative beliefs versus liberal beliefs, that the HUAC investigation was much ado about nothing and people's lives were needlessly ruined. People are still discussing that point today, 60 years later.
Wayne's career began in the 20s, but his big break, if there was one, and there probably was, and it's described in Scott's book, Stagecoach, 1939. He was 32 years old, and this is what made him the star that really dominated the screen for several decades thereafter.
Well, he fired the starting gun for his major league career, you might say. He made his first starring role in 1930, a big 70-millimeter epic called The Big Trail, about the westward expansion, a wagon train moving west. It was a very expensive picture. Fox regarded him as their new Tom Mix. They were sure he was going to be a big western star. The film opened and promptly closed. It was a financial catastrophe, and they basically hung it on this 22-year-old kid. So when he was 22, he was a burgeoning star of tomorrow. When he was 23, he was a washed-up has-been. And for the next 10 years, basically, he had to take what he could get. He made he had big parts in small films and small parts in big films. He was a jobbing actor, a lot of B-Westerns mostly. And he learned, it was a time in the wilderness, but it really taught him how to act. It taught him his craft. As I say in the book, he was a natural-born movie star.
We'll talk with Scott Hyman about John Wayne when we return. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633, your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. We continue with Scott Hyman. His book is John Wayne, The Life and Legend. And we were talking about Stagecoach, 1939. John Wayne is 32 years old. He's been in Hollywood for well over a decade. And boom, he becomes a superstar. It was not by coincidence that this happened. There was a long road to the success story that John Wayne crafted. You were telling us about what happened prior to Stagecoach when we hit the break, Scott.
Right.
He was.
Wayne had been friends with John Ford, the great director, since 1926 when he went to work at Fox as a summer job from USC, and they'd become friends because Ford was a big football guy. Ford had been a fullback on the Maine championship high school championship team, where he was known as Bull Feeney. And Wayne had been a lineman on the Glendale High School football team and been All-State. So they bonded, basically, because they were both football guys. But they became very close over the intervening years, and Wayne kind of kept wondering when Ford was going to tap him on the shoulder and make a movie with him. And the years went on, and Wayne kept working and kept working and kept working and learned his craft and learned how to act and learned how to react and learned his technique, which every actor has to have. And finally, in 1938, Ford said, okay, I'm going to use you in this movie called Stagecoach. And he carefully sculpted the entire movie around Wayne's presence. And everybody thought he was nuts. The producer wanted to use Gary Cooper or anybody. It didn't matter, because they felt that Wayne was damaged goods because he'd made so many down-market movies for almost 10 years. But Ford stuck to his guns and said he basically wasn't going to make the movie unless he could make the movie with John Wayne. So they went along with it because he was John Ford and because he was one of the top two or three directors in the business. The movie was made, came out in the spring of 39, was a considerable hit, and suddenly John Wayne didn't have to work in cheap B-Westerns anymore. John Wayne was a movie star.
Glenn in North Baton Rouge. Glenn, you're on the air with Scott Iman. Hi, Glenn.
Morning. I just have a question. We were African-American. We were brought up to adore John Wayne. That's what we imitated. We were getting into discussions sometimes. Some people say he was a racist. If you could clarify that.
Was he a racist?
Was he a racist? I would say no, he wasn't. He had attitudes that were indicative of a guy who was born in 1907 in the Edwardian era. On the other hand, one of the interviews I did was with a guy who spent a lot of time with him for an article in Life magazine in the 60s. And he said he was like a guy, the writer I was talking to was from New Jersey. He said he was like a guy from New Jersey. He would say things and you know, jostle people verbally. He said, but it was like you were a kid in New Jersey, and you say all these things, then you go have a beer with the guy. It wasn't anything personal. And with Wayne, his attitudes, his political attitudes were always superseded by his personal responses. If he liked you, he didn't care what color you were. If he liked you, he didn't care if you were liberal. If he liked you, he was willing to overlook almost anything short of murder. loyalty was his strongest virtue.
And
really,
if he didn't like you,
forget it. It didn't matter whether you were conservative or liberal or anything else. And he would. And as I said, he had a temper. There's a wonderful letter in the book where he calls written to Ronald Reagan, where he calls Reagan a damn liar over the Panama Canal. And he felt Reagan knew he was lying to people and was talking out of both sides of his mouth and called him on it, even though he loved Ronald Reagan and they were friends. And Ronald Reagan would have been probably his favorite president. He was always for the most conservative guy in the race. In 1952, he was for Robert Taft. Taft didn't get the nomination. Dwight Eisenhower got the nomination. So he was for Dwight Eisenhower, but he thought Dwight Eisenhower was a little too middle of the road. But in 1964, he was for Barry Goldwater, and he would have been a big Reagan supporter. But in the 1970s, when Reagan was not in the White House, he gave Reagan a very hard time. over Reagan telling conservatives not to give the Panama Canal back because he thought a deal was a deal, and Reagan should abide by the government's signing of the treaty.
Glenn in New Orleans. Glenn, good morning. You're on the air with Scott Iman.
Good morning. What was his view on how the Indians were portrayed in his movie? Did he ever change his views on that?
He thought he was very fair to the Indians. He would point to pictures that he was responsible for, like Hondo, where the Indians are portrayed as extremely honorable people fighting against the tide of history, fighting a battle they could not win. Or in McClintock, where another film he produced, where he thought he gave the Indians more than a fair shake. He did think that he got hung with the sins of the entire Hollywood film industry for the kind of reflexive knee-to-the-groin way that Indians were portrayed. But he would always say he thought he gave Indians more than a fair shake in his pictures.
297-5633, a few more minutes with Scott Eyman, and then we'll hear from Bernard Rose, the well-known director who's coming this way with a major production, The Devil's Violinist, showing at the International Film Festival in our midst. Was Wayne a tough guy?
No. Actually, he wasn't. He was tough emotionally, and he was tough psychologically, but I don't think he ever had a fight in his life. He generally, because of his screen image, occasionally guys would get, drunks would come up to him and challenge him, and he would always find a way to defuse the situation. He was not pugnacious at all. And as I said, when I met him, he wasn't the guy on the screen. You know, the guy on the screen was always ready to, cock a fist and slug somebody. The guy off screen was a much gentler, quieter soul than that. And he, because of his size, he was really large. I mean, he was 6'3 and 3 quarters. 250 pounds, a normal six-footer could stand in back of him, and you'd never see him. I mean, he was big. But that's not to say that people, wanted to go after, the big dog. So occasionally guys would challenge him, and he just wouldn't get into it. He would find a way to defuse the situation or buy them a drink and sit and talk with them so that they felt, they got to know the Duke. But he never got into brawls off-screen at all.
And he fought cancer for many years, finally succumbing to the disease at the age of 72. But that's something he didn't particularly like talking about, but he showed a lot of strength and resilience in his fight against cancer.
Oh, he was America's most famous cancer survivor. He lost his lung to cancer at the end of 1963, and he lasted 9 years. He lasted 16 years. He died in 79. When I met him in 1972, I was stunned to see him smoking a small black cigar. He was smoking cigars basically throughout our interview. And because even at that point, he was America's most famous cancer survivor, I hadn't expected to find him smoking. In fact, he never really quit. He would, if he was temporarily not smoking, he'd ask people to blow smoke in his face so he could at least inhale it. Or he'd chew tobacco, or he'd do something. But he was pretty well addicted to tobacco all of his life. Hard to find a picture of him off screen where he's not doesn't have a cigarette in his hands.
Okay, David Brown asks about "Reap the Wild Wind," another film of John Wayne's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he made that for Cecil B. DeMille during World War II. Very successful picture where he plays a kind of sympathetic heavy whose impetuousness brings disaster on himself and his efforts. He was worried about it because he wasn't a Paramount star. He was under contract to Republic, and he was going over to Paramount, and the film was otherwise made with Paramount stars Ray Milland and Paulette Goddard, and they were all in DeMille. They were all mainstays at Paramount, so he was figuring that they'd throw him to the wolves. But DeMille promised that he would take care of him, he'd come through fine in the film, and in fact they did. And DeMille adored him. Partially because of politics, DeMille also was quite conservative, mm-hmm. and Wayne was conservative as well, but also because he liked Wayne's style. And DeMille, who usually kept a kind of standoffish attitude towards actors, he didn't really care for actors and didn't associate with actors, but he would have Wayne eat at his table during lunch, which actors didn't do. Actors were not invited to eat at C.B. DeMille's lunch table, but he had Wayne eat with him regularly, so there was quite a simpatico there.
Jim Kleinpeter asked, what was Wayne's favorite role? Did he have one?
He liked Nathan Brittles in She Wore Yellow Ribbon. He liked Tom Dunson in Red River. He liked Ethan Edwards in The Searchers. And he liked Rooster Cogburn. Those are all pretty varied characters. There's not a lot of similarity between any of them.
Well, it shows his versatility.
That show off his versatility. But those were his, he felt those were his best, the best characters he had a chance to play.
But it's generally thought that the Rooster Cogburn role, the one that won him the Oscar, was not his best, that this was more or less a Lifetime Achievement Award when he got the Oscar.
And it came along at a real good time because he'd come out in favor of the Vietnam War. He'd made the Green Berets, which, again, was a marker between left and right, and there was a great deal of anger and vociferous protests from the part of the left and response on the part of the right. And he'd become a kind of a rallying cry for conservatives. And in making those pictures and coming out in favor of Vietnam, he really lost a generation of fans. If you were a teenager at this point or in your 20s, it's very few people thought that the Vietnam War was a great idea. So it cost him commercially, and he didn't care because he believed that we were right, and he came out in favor of the war. But true grit comes about 2 years after the Green Berets, and it washed away a lot of the bad taste left in people's mouths by that picture and by his political things, because it's non-political. It's he's kind of this feisty grandfather who's over the hill, but he's got enough left in the tank for one last hurrah. And he goes with all guns blazing. And, I mean, everybody liked it. It was a huge commercial hit. And it won him his Oscar, and it was indeed a career achievement award.
The book is The Life and Legend, John Wayne from Scott Eyman, and it is the definitive work up until now about John Wayne. And there have been other good books about the Duke, but Scott gets to the heart of the man behind the myth. What's your favorite Wayne film?
If I had to choose one, it would be either Red River or The Searchers, depending upon how bleak my mood is.
Well, it's a book that has humor, and it captures the dark side of John Wayne, if there was one. And as with most people, there is generally a side that we don't show the public at large. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Jim. Pleasure to be here.
Nice talking with you, and congratulations.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We're joined now by Bernard Rose, and he is a celebrated English actor and film director, most famous for his direction of the 1992 urban horror film Candyman and the historical romance film Immortal Beloved, 1994, and he is part of the Louisiana International Film Festival that is taking place May 8th through the 11th at Perkins Row. John Wirt writes about it in today's Advocate. This year's slate of more than 50 films includes the North American screenings of Roman Polanski's Venus and Fur and many others, and The Devil's Violinist is one that we'll be waiting for, and it'll be showing at the film festival. Good morning, Bernard Rose.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You are a veteran filmmaker. And as I stated, you've had a varied background, but I know you're quite proud of the 2013 film, The Devil's Violinist.
Yes. Well, yes, the film is basically a film about Niccolo Paganini, who in the 1830s was basically the world's first rock star. He was a violinist, and he was the first man who, instead of working for a patron, working for a lord, or working for some king in his house playing the violin, he went on tour and played concerts and charged for them, and people went crazy for him. He did things on the violin that people thought were impossible, and the rumor grew up about him that what he was doing was supernatural, and that he, in order to play the violin like that, he'd sold his soul to the devil. And funnily enough, this theory of a musician selling their soul to the devil has recurred throughout history since then. But Niccolo Paganini was the first person about whom this was said. And so that the movie kind of takes that as fact and is kind of the Faustian bargain between Paganini and the devil, who then takes him on tour and makes him a rock star. Is basically what the film is.
What attracted you to this project about this Italian violinist and composer Paganini?
Well, you know, for me, it is this moment in history where, as I said, that music ceased to be, you know, obviously in an era before any form of mechanical reproduction of music, if you wanted music, you had to have musicians in your house. The musicians were basically employees. They were servants. And this is the moment where a musician says, I'm not a servant. What I do is worth a lot of money. I'm going to go out on tour, and I'm going to become a star. And so in that sense, he kind of changed the way that people perceive music, certainly as an economic force. And what he did was so extraordinary that he changed the way people played the violin and the way that they presented themselves on stage. A lot of people came after him, like Liszt, and who was the famous pianist, and they all were like Paganini, the rock stars of their day. And you know, like a modern rock star, women would go crazy for him, and there was all the same trouble that happens to modern rock stars with women and substance abuse and everything else. And so in that sense, he kind of, it's part of the formation of the modern world, and it's kind of interesting sometimes to go back and look at how these things start. And mm-hmm. Paganini was the beginning of something that that we still live with today.
Well, The Devil's Violinist will show a week from tomorrow, Saturday the 10th, and Sunday the 11th at Perkins Row as part of the Louisiana International Film Festival. The gentleman who's the lead actor in the film, David Garrett, he's gotten a very good response for what he has done on the screen. What prompted you to cast him?
Well, David, apart from being disgracefully handsome, is also a virtuoso violinist. And, you know, indeed, what Paganini did on the violin was, I mean, he did things which are considered even today practically impossible to actually pull off. So, you know, your choice, if you're going to make a film like this, is do you hire an actor and then have him try and mime it or in some way do a special effect so that it looks like it's happening, or do you hire somebody who can actually do it for real? And it seemed to me that if the film was about the incredible, phenomenal things that Paganini could do with his violin on stage, if you didn't actually see what he could do, you wouldn't understand what the fuss was about. So, you know, it would be like making a film, a dance film without Fred Astaire, but with somebody who was pretending to dance. Yeah, so to me, it was critical that we had a real violinist rather than somebody pretending to play. And obviously, David does play everything that's in the movie. And he lives that life. He is a concert virtuoso. He's from Germany, and he's a big star there. And he's like a rock star violinist. He has a show that's kind of a crossover show that combines modern pieces as well as classical pieces. You know, he's a serious classical violinist, too. He can play any kind of serious concerto with any orchestra, but he can also do a rock show. And I thought that was a really interesting combination, because that's pretty much how Paganini would have been.
Hold tight. We'll be back and spend a bit more time with Bernard Rose, the director of The Devil's Violinist, coming to the Louisiana International Film Festival. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. And we continue with Bernard Rose, the director of The Devil's Violinist, coming to Perkins Row as part of the Louisiana International Film Festival next Saturday and Sunday. Viewers will have a chance to see this fine film. The man who made it possible, Bernard Rose, who's had a successful career directing all kinds of films, starting in 1986 with Smart Money, is still going strong in 2014. We had some listeners comment about some of your previous works, Two Jacks, Boxing Day. You've had a varied career, haven't you?
I certainly have, yeah.
So what... go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I was saying you do all kinds of things. And I'm sure you have a concept in your mind, and this Paganini thing, is this something you had been thinking about for some time?
Yeah, absolutely. I had an interest. I've made horror films. I made the classic horror film Candyman, amongst others. But I also have a love of classical music. I actually trained as a classical pianist. Before I was a filmmaker, and I made Immortal Beloved film about Beethoven. And it's always been a passion of mine to try and make films that kind of introduce classical music to a new audience or a broader audience that normally doesn't reach because they think it's not for them somehow. I think that one of the mistakes of the modern classical music business is that people feel that it's not for them, it's somehow other And, you know, it's just music. And when it first came out, this was the popular music of its day. And a lot of it really still speaks to us. Music is unlike any other art. It doesn't need explanation. It doesn't need, you don't need to understand it. You just need to hear it. And it will affect you. And there's so much emotion and beauty and power in a lot of this music from the 19th century. And indeed the 18th century, but in particular the 19th century, there's so much fantastic music from that era that it's really worth people exploring it. And I think that when I was a kid, there was in the UK, there was a filmmaker called Ken Russell who made a number of films that were about classical composers and classical music, most notably The Music Lovers, about Tchaikovsky. These films kind of introduced me to classical music in a way that took it away from the stuffiness of the concert hall, and that really it really changed things for me as a teenager. And so, in some way, I think when I was making Immortal Beloved and when I'm doing this Paganini film, that's what I'd like to try and do, is just try and find a way of just saying to people, no, listen to this music, mm-hmm. listen to Beethoven. This stuff's really powerful, and if you let it into your life, you'll never regret it. It's something that you can enjoy for your entire life. There's so much richness there and so much beauty.
Do you think that movies made abroad generally have a different texture than movies made domestically in the United States?
Well, I've done both, obviously. And for me, in a sense, it's the same thing. But, you know, I think that movies reflect the culture that they're made in, and the culture in Europe is different from the culture in the United States. So in that sense, they're different. But from a technical and production point of view, they're the same. And a lot of American movies, or what we think of as American movies, are made in Europe, just most often for financial and tax reasons, actually. So I think in a technical sense, there's no difference. But in a cultural sense, There's a tremendous difference, it just in terms of how things are approached. I mean, one of the interesting things about Hollywood and the Hollywood ethos, which, you know, in Europe in the 19th century, there was drama was two categories. There was tragedy, which ended with a flawed hero's death, and there was comedy, which ended with the participants getting married. When Hollywood started up in the 100 years ago, was really when it got going, there became this kind of hybrid form of drama with a happy ending, which is sort of the great invention of Hollywood. This idea that a tragic or violent or moving drama would end in the same manner as a comedy would have done traditionally, as per the kind of theories of 19th century theater that were prevalent in Europe, especially in Britain, which is where most theatrical traditions grew up, at least modern theatrical traditions. And you could say, well, why did this happen? And actually, I have a very interesting theory about that, which was that there was a branch of theater which did combine this hybrid of the tragic melodramatic story with the happy romantic ending, and that was actually the very rich tradition of Yiddish theater, which grew up in New York and in the diaspora amongst Yiddish-speaking people. And a lot of the guys who ran Hollywood or started Hollywood in Los Angeles 100 years ago, that was the dramatic tradition that they'd grown up with. And it's interesting how that then sort of seeped into the mainstream and became the Hollywood tradition. And it's actually a very interesting and subtle change in how drama kind mm-hmm. of morphed over 100 years ago. And it's also, I think, that's a very typically American thing.
Well, Bernard Rose will have his magnificent work, The Devil's Violinist, on the big screen at Perkins Row as part of the Louisiana International Film Festival next weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and tickets for individual films can be secured by going online, lifilmfest.org. That's lifilmfest.org. We thank you for joining us today, Bernard, and congratulations on another fine work.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it. And Mr. Rose began his career working for the Muppet Show, so he has had a varied background. We look forward to seeing the Devil's Violinist. In studio is a person with a varied background, Leslie Todd, and we're going to talk about her current endeavors. But you came to our community more than 30 years ago to teach English at LSU, right?
That's right. I did.
And along the way, you kind of got into other things, right?
I did. I changed careers. Mm-hmm.
Well, how's that going?
It's been going pretty well. I actually... I was teaching freshman English at LSU from 1980 to 1985, and I actually had a nephew commit suicide. And I went back to my students, and I started asking questions about teenage suicide, and I learned that a third of those kids knew someone who'd committed suicide or had thought about it. And I said to myself, okay, I know what I need to do. And so I switched careers.
And that's what you do. You're a parenting advisor.
Well, I'm a psychotherapist, and I see families and stepfamilies as well as individuals, but I'm also a mediator, a parenting coordinator, and a child custody evaluator, and those things have to do with the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts.
And our definition of family is evolving as we speak.
It is. More than any other country in the world, Americans churn through relationships, and churning means that they change partners quickly. So 10% of American women have had three or more partners, marriages, or divorces by the age of 35, whereas the next closest country, Sweden, has only had like 3%.
Well, how do you describe a partner?
Well, that would be anybody that you live with children or not. My concerns, of course, have to do with children. 1 million children a year are affected by parents breaking up.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do children respond to parents who have multiple partners over the course of their lives?
It doesn't go well, and that's one of our concerns, depending on the age of the children, the stability of the relationships. But clearly, if you have a lot of churning, a lot of turnover, that is a lot of instability. It also has to do with a lot of poverty, a lot of economic problems. And what I'm interested in is that our family courts are beginning to do a much better job, particularly here in East Baton Rouge, of really understanding these problems, because what we're doing is we're getting the mental health people involved with the court system. And while the court is all about the letter of the law, we are bringing to them some understanding of the spirit of the law, as I would call it, the needs of the children. And so the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts is an association of the judges, the mental health, and the attorneys, mental health people and the attorneys, mm-hmm. so that we are now interdisciplinary and working together to make a better system. These are already dysfunctional families, and they're going through a dysfunctional system because the court system by nature was adversarial. So we're lucky to have the dedicated family court judges here in East Baton Rouge Parish who have a better understanding of that. And my hope is that we'll see more dedicated family court judges around the state. That's one of the things we're hoping for.
Leslie Todd is the person we're talking with, the voice you're hearing. She is a psychotherapist, is married to a psychologist, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and so it is something that she knows well, the terrain of family issues, and quite often family court is the most contentious place in a courthouse. And
yes.
There's this competitive parenting that is quite often part of the arguments.
Yes.
How pervasive is this, and what do you do about it?
Well, Jim, you remember a couple weeks ago you had Jennifer Senior on, and she was talking about her book, All Joy, No Fun, which is a great book about the stresses of parenting. And what I was really interested in that was she going to talk at all about the stresses of divorced parenting? Because I believe that parents are already so anxious and upset with the divorce that they bind that anxiety to their children, and they engage in a lot of competitive parenting, especially if they're really high-conflict people. High-conflict people are the ones who are in court for 3 to 5 years after the divorce with repetitive litigation. And those are the people we're especially trying to help because they're traumatized and they're working it out in the court system. So, yes, that's tough on the kids. It's also tough on the attorneys and the judges.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we mental health people have done some good in helping them by promoting mediation instead of adversarial work. And a lot of the attorneys here in town now are turning to do mediation instead of litigation.
But quite often these disputes don't bring out the best in people.
No, they don't. And part of that is domestic violence, which, of course, that's a chronic problem. But with some people, it's a situational problem only around the time of the divorce. And those people can calm mm-hmm. down. So we're having a conference on June 3rd on domestic violence, which is going to have a lot of the kind of stars of the system here. We'll have Chief Judge Pam Baker, who's a wonderful leader in our field, Hiller Moore, Chief Dabadi, Melanie Fields, who's a prosecutor, Laura Prosser, Judge Guidry, all these people, and Alan Taylor, my husband, and Brandon Romano, another psychologist, all talking about this problem.
When will this be?
That'll be June 3rd. It's for the professionals, and it'll be at the Embassy Suites. Okay. We'll be publicizing that more.
Now, you noted that in our world today that people tend to float from partner to partner, and over the course of time the numbers add up, and it's generally not a good thing. At least children don't respond well to it. But is the perception different for a man who does something like this than it is for a woman?
I don't think so. The way I filter things is through their mental stability, not their gender, or even if they're partnered with somebody the same gender. It has to do with the stability they're providing for the children. Remember, when people repartner, there's often moving to a new house, moving to a new school, even moving to a new location. There's a lot of other things involved for the children. And a lot of times the parents don't really consider that. So the parents get caught up in their own needs sometimes and don't really see. Also, step-family dynamics, which is one of my favorite subjects. You've got two new tribes reuniting, mm-hmm. so that's a little odd. And then you've got what I call Planet Mom and Planet Dad. The Planet Mom, you know, she might stay single, and so things run kind of smoothly because the kids know what that's like. If Dad remarries, Planet Dad might have a step-family, and that is a very different thing that children have to get used to.
What are generally the biggest areas of contention?
I would say the biggest areas of contention are the amount of time each parent has with a child, because there is a perceived belief that 50-50 is the, quote, fair thing to do, and that may not be mm-hmm. the best thing for children in all cases.
Well, the world we live in is such that I think now more than half of all marriages end in divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people stay married who are really not all that happy with their conditions.
They think they're helping their kids, right.
So generally, kids get caught in the crossfire.
Yes.
And these things that happen early in life, they quite often affect us later in life, don't they?
They do. And people who have been traumatized in their youth are the ones who tend to do worse with a divorce. They're being re-traumatized by the divorce. Any abandonment issues they had from their own childhood gets replayed through the divorce.
Mm-hmm.
So those tend to be the people, and also those who have personality disorders, tend to be the people who are the ones who relitigate.
But that said, nobody goes through life, even in the most successful of unions, without some disputes. And it's quite often how well those disputes are resolved that determine whether the relationship moves forward.
Right. There are many people who have almost kind of operatic arguments, but the kids know that that's just how mom and dad hash things out, and they're okay. I've known a lot of Italian families and Cuban families like that. Mm-hmm. They're kind of louder, but they get their problems worked out.
Mm-hmm. Is infidelity still a major issue in disputes?
No, Jim, no one's unfaithful anymore. You know that. Well, yes, it is. It's a terrible
problem.
Is that the
biggest thing?
Well, you can sit on the sofa next to your spouse and be looking at porn on your iPhone, you know, or texting your girlfriend. So, yes, it's a really bad problem.
So there are more ways to be unfaithful.
Absolutely.
Now,
the boundaries are so porous now that there are so many opportunities for any degree of unfaithfulness.
So what do you do?
Call Save Wesley? Save that for the next episode.
Well, there are a lot of ways to step out now, and there are ways to get caught now that perhaps we're not in place.
And all exes are experts at befriending their exes' exes on Facebook. That's what happens.
Well, thank you, Leslie Todd, and we look forward to another conversation with you soon. Thank you, Jim. Have a good weekend, everybody. Until Monday, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.